The ugly stain of racism manifests itself in many different ways in 21st century America. And because African Americans and Latinos tended to have most of their wealth tied up in their homes, the total net worth of African American households fell by more than 50% and by more than 65% for Latino families. Today, 9 years after the housing crisis began, 4.3 million homeowners still owe more than their houses are worth. Further, as a result of the ongoing housing crisis, more than a quarter of the nation's 43 million renter households pay at least half their incomes for housing, leaving precious little for other necessities like food and medicine. What a rigged financial system looks like. Wall Street is the most powerful institution in this country, and the financial leaders there wield that power ferociously to protect their interests. As a result of the revolving door between Wall Street and the federal government, the needs and interests of the giant banks become converted into government policy. Not only does Wall Street have an endless supply of powerful people to lobby government, they hold key positions within the government, including two recent secretaries of the Treasury from Goldman Sachs. No matter how irresponsible their actions are, the financial titans always end up on top. Millions still suffer as a result of the Wall Street crash, but not the people in power who helped cause the disaster. While middle-class Americans lost their jobs, their homes, and their life savings, the people on top are doing phenomenally well. Here are just a few examples of people who are operating the levers of government and push policies that helped to create the Great Recession of 2008. Robert Rubin. Robert Rubin stands out as the poster child for the revolving door that exists between Wall Street and Washington. Rubin started his career by making a fortune at Goldman Sachs, where he worked for 26 years, including 2 years as its co-chairman. In 1993, President Clinton appointed him the head of the National Economic Council, and in 1995, he became Treasury Secretary. While in government, he spearheaded financial deregulation, including the repeal of Glass-Steagall. He also prevented the regulation of derivatives. In 1999, Rubin returned to Wall Street, and after brokering a deal with Republicans to legalize the $70 billion merger between Citicorp and Travelers Group, he was hired by the newly formed Citigroup and received about $15 million a year for his services. Less than a decade later, a decade in which Rubin earned more than $126 million at Citigroup, taxpayers bailed out his mega bank because of the enormous risks Rubin and others encouraged it to take. In 2010, the Bipartisan Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, FCIC, voted unanimously to refer Rubin to the Justice Department for potential fraud, for misleading investors about Citigroup's exposure to subprime mortgages. When DOJ declined to act, Phil Angelides, chair of the FCIC, said, "It's been a disappointment to me and others that the Justice Department has not pursued the potential wrongdoing by individuals identified in the matters we referred to them. At the very least, they owe the American people the reassurance that they conducted a thorough investigation of individuals who engaged in misconduct." I couldn't agree more. Henry Hank Paulson. Like Rubin, a Democrat, Hank Paulson, who is a Republican, was a leader at Goldman Sachs. He was the CEO there from 1999 to 2006. While there, he accumulated 4.5 million shares of Goldman stock, and in the last year, he received a $45 million bonus. Under Paulson's leadership, Goldman engaged in the kinds of reckless schemes that led to the financial crisis just a few years later. After George W. Bush nominated Paulson to become Treasury Secretary in 2006, he had to sell his stocks to avoid a conflict of interest, netting about $600 million. As Treasury Secretary, Paulson repeatedly defended the deregulation of Wall Street assuring Congress and the world that the markets were strong and the financial system stable. That is, until one day, when he came before the Senate Democratic and Republican caucuses, handed us a 3-page bill, and said that if we did not give him a $700 billion blank check within a few days, the entire financial system would collapse. The great defender of free market capitalism came to Congress for a bailout, and the largest welfare check in the history of the country. At the meeting of the Democratic caucus, I suggested to Paulson that he ask his banker and billionaire friends who benefited from the excesses of Wall Street rather than middle-class taxpayers to pick up the tab. Needless to say, Paulson disagreed. Hank Paulson is now worth an estimated $700 million. Tim Geithner. A Robert Rubin acolyte. Geithner was president of the New York Federal Reserve between 2003 and 2009. In this position, he failed to ensure the safety and soundness of financial institutions before, during, and after the financial crisis. Instead of losing his job, Geithner was promoted by President Obama to Treasury Secretary, in which capacity he opposed strong efforts to regulate Wall Street, break up the banks, claw back executive bonuses, and protect underwater homeowners. After leaving Treasury, Geithner landed a job as president of the multi-billion dollar hedge fund, where he received a generous line of credit from J.P. Morgan Chase, a bank that received over $400 billion in financial assistance from, you guessed it, the New York Fed and the Treasury Department. Alan Greenspan. In my view, Alan Greenspan will go down in history as one of the worst chairmen of the Federal Reserve. Future textbooks will refer to Greenspan as an example of how not to run a central bank. In order to underline the bipartisan support that Wall Street has in Congress, during his time of leadership at the Fed, he was hailed not only by the Republicans, but also by Democrats as the maestro. This despite his extremely conservative views, which called for, among other reactionary policies, the elimination of the minimum wage. In 2000, at a House Financial Service Committee hearing on bank mergers, I asked Greenspan, "Aren't you concerned that with such a growing concentration of wealth, if one of these huge institutions fails, it will have a horrendous impact on the national and global economy?" Greenspan replied, "No, I'm not. I believe that the general growth in large institutions has occurred in the context of an underlying structure of markets in which many of the larger risks are dramatically, I should say, fully hedged." Greenspan could not have been more wrong. Yet after leaving the Fed, he was hired to advise some of the biggest banks and wealthiest hedge fund managers in the world. He now has an estimated worth of at least $10 million. And on it goes. And the rich get richer. Median household income has gone down by $1,400 since 1999, but banks made a record-breaking profit of $164 billion in 2015 alone. The top 25 hedge fund managers made more in 2015 than the combined salaries of every kindergarten teacher in America while paying a lower tax rate than most truck drivers and nurses. Millions of Americans lost much of their wealth during the foreclosure crisis, but one hedge fund manager alone made almost $4 billion on their economic pain by betting that the housing market would collapse. While taxpayers provide over $1 trillion in financial assistance to bail out Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan Chase, today the CEOs of these financial institutions are worth over $1 billion each. The reality is that Wall Street executives continue to receive huge compensation packages and bonuses as if the financial crisis they created never happened. The business model on Wall Street is a fraud. It seems like every few weeks we read about a giant financial institution that has been fined or that has reached a settlement for illegal behavior. Some people believe this is an aberration, that we have an honest financial system in which, every now and then, a major institution does something wrong and gets caught. Unfortunately, the overwhelming evidence suggests otherwise. The reality is that fraud is the business model on Wall Street. It is not the exception to the rule, it is the rule. And in the weak regulatory climate we have, Wall Street likely gets away with a lot more illegal behavior than we even know about. How many times have we heard the myth that what Wall Street did may have been wrong, but it wasn't illegal? It's time to shatter that myth once and for all. Since 2009, major banks have been fined more than $200 billion for reckless, unfair, and deceptive activities. Here are just a few examples. In August 2014, Bank of America paid more than $16 billion to settle charges that it lied to investors about the riskiness of the mortgage-backed securities it sold during the run-up to the crisis. In April 2016, Goldman Sachs reached a $5 billion settlement for marketing and selling fraudulent mortgage-backed securities that were the foundation of the housing crisis. This is in addition to the $550 million Goldman paid to settle another 2010 fraudulent mortgage case. In April 2016, Wells Fargo reached a $1.2 billion settlement with the Department of Justice, DOJ, for reckless and shoddy underwriting on thousands of home loans from 2001 to 2008. In February 2016, Morgan Stanley reached a $3.2 billion settlement with the DOJ and several states for misleading investors about the quality of the mortgage bonds it was selling. In February 2016, HSBC reached a $601 million settlement with the DOJ and other federal and state agencies for abusive mortgage lending practices. In July 2014, Citigroup reached a $7 billion settlement for mortgage fraud. Then Attorney General Eric Holder said Citigroup's activities contributed mightily to the financial crisis that devastated our economy in 2008. The bank's misconduct was egregious as a result of their assurances that toxic financial products were sound. Citigroup was able to expand its market share and increase profits. Richard Bowen, a former Citigroup executive turned whistleblower, added, "In July of 2008, I gave the SEC 1,000 pages documenting fraud and the false representations given to investors in many securitizations. In light of the huge losses this behavior caused our country, it is outrageous that 6 years later, a settlement of only civil fraud charges would be announced, with no individuals being held accountable and no real admission of wrongdoing or true penalties assessed." In November 2013, J.P. Morgan Chase settled for $13 billion for lying to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac about the quality of mortgage-backed securities it sold them. Settlement documents revealed how every large bank in the U.S. committed mortgage fraud. In 2011, J.P. Morgan also admitted to wrongly foreclosing on some military families and overcharging 4,500 more for their mortgages. "We have failed to comply with the aspects of the law," admitted an executive vice president. In 2011, the Justice Department fined Bank of America, which had purchased Countrywide, $335 million because Countrywide charged 200,000 minority homeowners more for their mortgages than they did whites and steered them into risky subprime loans designed to fail. In 2012, Wells Fargo was fined $175 million to settle similar claims of discriminatory and predatory subprime lending in black and Hispanic neighborhoods. According to sworn affidavits, Wells Fargo loan officers referred to black customers as mud people and called their subprime mortgages ghetto loans. Maybe you're thinking, that the illegal behavior of the executives at these huge financial institutions was limited to the housing crisis, that it was a one-time thing. I'm afraid not. Fraud is their business model through and through. In July 2016, State Street Bank reached a $382 million settlement with DOJ for rigging foreign currency exchange. In 2014, the French bank BNP Paribas was ordered to pay $8.9 billion in penalties by a U.S. district judge after pleading guilty to charges of violating U.S. money laundering laws by conducting business in Sudan, Iran, and Cuba. In July 2016, HSBC was fined $1.9 billion after senior DOJ officials overruled the recommendation by prosecutors to pursue criminal charges for laundering Mexican drug trafficking money because it could result in global financial disaster. In May 2015, five banks, including JPMorgan Chase and Citigroup, paid a $5.4 billion fine after pleading guilty to a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation, according to Attorney General Loretta Lynch. In February 2015, 10 banks, including Goldman Sachs and JPMorgan Chase, were investigated for tampering with the process of setting the price of precious metals for global markets. In March 2014, the FDIC accused 16 big banks, including Bank of America, Citigroup, and JPMorgan Chase, of fraud and conspiracy in an epic plot to manipulate bank-to-bank interest rates that underpin at least $350 trillion in global financial transactions. In April 2011, Wachovia, since acquired by Wells Fargo, was fined for laundering billions of dollars in illegal drug money. The federal prosecutor said, Wachovia's blatant disregard for our banking laws gave international cocaine cartels a virtual carte blanche to finance their operations. The fine was less than 2% of the bank's $12.3 billion profit in 2009. In July 2016, JPMorgan Chase paid $200 million to settle criminal and civil charges related to bribing foreign officials. Of course, these are just a few examples that demonstrate what I mean when I say that the business model of Wall Street is fraud. Money laundering, currency manipulation, bribery, conspiracy, rate tampering, collusion. These are the routine practices of Wall Street, and this is not just my opinion. This is what a number of financial executives themselves have acknowledged. In a 2015 University of Notre Dame survey on ethics in the financial service industry, 51% of Wall Street executives thought it was likely that their competitors engaged in unethical or illegal activity to gain an edge. More than one-third have either witnessed or have first-hand knowledge of wrongdoing. Nearly one in five believes they must engage in illegal or unethical activity to be successful. And a quarter have signed or been asked to sign confidentiality agreements that prohibit reporting illegal or unethical activities to the authorities. When a bank from Barclays was caught trying to rig the $5 trillion per day currency market in 2010, he said blithely, "If you ain't cheating, you ain't trying." And in 2008, an analyst from Standard & Poor's, a credit rating agency that consistently and knowingly gave AAA ratings to near worthless mortgage-backed securities, said, "Let's hope we're all wealthy and retired by the time this house of cards falters." Our country can no longer afford to tolerate the culture of fraud and corruption on Wall Street. The people responsible for illegal behavior must be held accountable. Unfortunately, that has not been the case so far. Ending Too Big to Jail. It's no secret that millions of Americans have become disillusioned with our political process. They don't vote. They don't believe much of what comes out of Washington. they've concluded that the system is rigged. In my view, one of the reasons for that deep cynicism is that people see different rules for the rich and powerful than for everyone else. They see kids arrested and sometimes even jailed for possessing marijuana or for other minor crimes. But when it comes to Wall Street executives, whose illegal behaviors hurts millions of Americans, they see that somehow there are no arrests, no police records, and no jail time. We're supposed to be a country of laws and equal justice. There's not supposed to be one standard for Wall Street executives and another for everybody else. Wall Street caused incalculable harm to our country, and the people who were responsible must be held to account. That is why in 2013, I was stunned when our country's top law enforcement officials suggested it might be difficult to prosecute executives of major financial institutions who commit crimes because it could destabilize the financial system of our country and the world. Since when did that become a criterion for deciding whether or not to prosecute the law? Then Attorney General Eric Holder told the Senate Judiciary Committee, "I am concerned that the size of some of these institutions becomes so large that it does become difficult for us to prosecute them when we are hit with indications that if we do prosecute, if we do bring criminal charge, it will have a negative impact on the national economy, perhaps even the world economy." In other words, not only are Wall Street banks too big to fail, their executives are too big to jail. After leaving his job as Attorney General, Holder returned to the giant law firm where he previously worked, Cummington and Burling, whose clients just so happened to include J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, some of the largest financial institutions in America. There's something fundamentally wrong with our criminal justice system when not one major Wall Street executive has been prosecuted for causing the near collapse of our entire economy. That has got to change. Equal justice under law cannot just be words engraved on the entrance of the Supreme Court. It must be the standard that applies to all Americans, including Wall Street executives. Where do we go from here? The time is long overdue for real financial reform in this country. It will not be easy given the enormous power of Wall Street and its political supporters, but it is absolutely necessary if we are to have the kind of strong and stable economy that we need to rebuild the shrinking middle class. The heads, bankers win, tails, everyone else loses, system must come to an end. We need to create a financial system that works for ordinary Americans, not just those on top. Here are just some of the steps forward that will help us achieve that goal. Ending too big to fail. To create an economy that works for all Americans and not just a handful of billionaires, we have got to address the ever-increasing size of the megabanks. And we must end once and for all the scheme that is nothing more than a free insurance policy for Wall Street, the policy of too big to fail. We need a banking system that is part of a productive economy, making loans at affordable rates to small and medium-sized businesses so that we can create a growing economy and decent-paying jobs. We need a banking system that encourages home ownership by offering affordable mortgage products that are designed to work for both the lender and the borrower. We need a banking system that is transparent and accountable, and that adheres to the highest ethical standards as well as to the spirit and letter of the law. This is not the banking system we have today. Wall Street cannot continue to be an island unto itself, gambling trillions of other people's money on risky derivatives, acting illegally, and making huge profits, all the while assured that if its schemes fail, the taxpayers will be there to bail them out. Of course, that is precisely what happened in 2008, when taxpayers bailed out Wall Street. Financial institutions received a $700 billion gift from Congress, and thanks to an amendment I offered in 2010, we were able to learn that the Federal Reserve provided $16 trillion in secret loans to some of the largest financial institutions and corporations in the U.S. and throughout the world. We were told these unprecedented actions were necessary because the financial institutions involved were simply too big to fail. In other words, they were so large and intertwined with all aspects of the economy that if they collapsed, the U.S. economy and maybe the entire global economy would go down with them. One might have thought that as part of the bailout, these huge banks would have been reduced in size to make certain that we never experience a reoccurrence of what happened in 2008. Well, that's not exactly what happened. In fact, the very opposite occurred. Today, three of the four largest financial institutions, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Wells Fargo, are about 80% bigger than they were before we bailed them out. Today, the six largest banks issue more than two-thirds of all credit cards and more than 35% of all mortgages. They control more than 95% of financial derivatives and more than 40% of all bank deposits. Their assets have almost quadrupled since the mid-1990s and are now equivalent to nearly 60% of our GDP. If these banks were too big to fail in 2008, what would happen if any of them were to fail today? The taxpayers would be on the hook again, and almost certainly for more money than in the last bailout. We cannot allow that to happen. No financial institution should be so large that its failure would cause the catastrophic risk to millions of Americans or to our nation's economic well-being. No financial institution should have holdings so extensive that its failure would send the world economy into crisis. If a bank is too big to fail, it is too big to exist. When it comes to Wall Street reform, that must be our bottom line. This is true not just because of the risk to our economy of another collapse and another bailout. It is also true because the current extreme concentration of ownership in the financial industry allows a very small number of huge financial institutions to have far too much economic and political power over this country. If Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican trustbuster, were alive today, he would say, "Break 'em up!" And he'd be right. Here's how we can do it. We must pass legislation to cap the size of the largest financial institutions in this country so that their assets are no more than 2% of the GDP, which is equal to about $350 billion today. This would break up the 10 biggest banks in the country, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, U.S. Bank Corp, PNC, Bank of New York Mellon. This is not a radical idea. Under this plan, the size of J.P. Morgan Chase would simply go back to where it was in 1997. Bank of America would shrink to where it was in 1998. Wells Fargo would go down to where it was in 2002, and Citigroup would shrink to where it was during the second term of Bill Clinton's administration. Breaking up the big banks would reduce systemic risk in our financial system. It would also mean increased competition. Oligopolies, where the market is dominated by just a few economic actors, are never good for consumers. Smaller banks are more likely to offer affordable financial products that Americans actually want and need, and consumers would have more banking products to choose from. The idea of breaking up the too big to fail banks is supported not only by a number of progressive economists, but also by some leading figures in the financial community. The Independent Community Bankers of America, representing 6,000 community banks, supports the idea because they understand that the function of banking should not be about speculation and derivatives and other esoteric financial instruments. Rather, it should be about providing affordable loans to businesses to create jobs in a productive economy and providing Americans with loans they can afford to purchase homes, cars, and other consumer needs. In other words, the function of banking should be boring. Past and present presidents of Federal Reserve Banks in Dallas, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Minneapolis also support breaking up these behemoth banks. While these individuals are much more conservative than I am, all of them understand how dangerous too big to fail banks are to our economy. And I am proud that for the first time, the Democratic Party is on record as supporting this concept as well, thanks to an agreement our campaign worked out with Hillary Clinton's campaign. The 2016 Democratic National Committee platform declares, banks should not be able to gamble with taxpayer deposits or pose an undue risk to Main Street. Democrats support a variety of ways to stop this from happening, including breaking up too-big-to-fail financial institutions that pose a systemic risk to the stability of our economy. This is a very important political step forward. Now it is our job to make sure the next president in Congress turn that platform statement into reality. Enacting a 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act. In 1933, President Franklin Roosevelt signed the Glass-Steagall Act as an emergency response to the failure of nearly 5,000 banks during the Great Depression. The law protected the deposits of ordinary people by creating a firewall between taxpayer-insured commercial banks on one side and investment banks and insurance services on the other. It effectively kept Wall Street speculators from gambling with other people's money and prevented another banking meltdown for more than 5 decades. That is, until Wall Street got Congress to dilute it under President Reagan and kill it under President Bill Clinton. In 1999, I was proud to lead the fight in the House of Representatives against repealing Glass-Steagall. During the floor debate, I warned that repealing the law will lead to fewer banks and financial service providers, increased charges and fees for individual consumers and small businesses, diminished credit for rural America, and taxpayer exposure to potential losses should a financial conglomerate fail. It will lead to more mega mergers, a small number of corporations dominating the financial service industry, and further concentration of economic power in our country. I wish that I had been wrong. But, unfortunately, what actually happened in 2008 was even worse than I predicted. Allowing commercial banks to merge with investment banks and insurance companies in 1999 was a huge mistake. It precipitated the largest taxpayer bailout in the history of the world. It substantially increased wealth and income inequality and further concentrated economic power in this country. It is time again to separate everyday banking functions from the far riskier activities of investment banking and insurance services. Wall Street should not be able to gamble with your bank deposits. It is time to pass the 21st Century Glass-Steagall Act legislation that Senator Elizabeth Warren and I and others have worked on. Regulating risky derivatives. We must also provide greater stability and transparency to the financial system by prohibiting taxpayer-insured banks from holding derivative contracts on their balance sheets. Derivatives, like credit card default swaps and synthetic collateralized debt obligations, are the risky financial products that nearly destroyed the economy. They are basically insurance policies on future events that may or may not happen, like a corporate bankruptcy, or a drop in oil prices, or the collapse of the housing market. Their value is based on the performance of an underlying asset, but as we saw during the financial crisis, the underlying assets are sometimes worthless. Yet, that doesn't keep Wall Street from speculating on these complex financial instruments. In fact, today, commercial banks still have over $190 trillion of derivatives contracts on their books. That's insane. And I'm not alone in thinking that. As far back as 1992, Felix Rohatyn, the investment banker who helped New York out of its financial crisis in the 1970s, described derivatives as the equivalent of financial hydrogen bombs. The billionaire financier, George Soros, has said that he doesn't dabble in derivatives because we don't really understand how they work. And 5 years before the Wall Street crash, Warren Buffett, the Oracle of Omaha, warned his investors that derivatives were, financial weapons of mass destruction carrying dangers that, while now latent, are potentially lethal. Roy Ayton, Soros, and Buffett were all correct in their assessment of derivatives. That is why we must make sure derivatives that are held in investment banks, hedge funds, and private equity funds are strongly regulated. Right now, state insurance commissioners and gambling authorities are banned from regulating them. We must lift that ban. They should be treated and regulated like the high-stakes wagers they are. In addition, all derivatives trading should be done in an open, transparent exchange, similar to the stock market, without exceptions. As it stands now, these already complex and mysterious instruments are mostly traded in the shadows. It's time to bring them into the sunlight and see if they can withstand the scrutiny. Finally, financial regulators must ensure that all of the participants in the derivatives market have enough capital to pay up if they lose their bets. Remember, derivatives are essentially insurance policies. Can you imagine paying for a fire insurance on your house for 20 years, but when the house burns down, the insurer says it doesn't actually have any money to pay your claim? Without sufficient capital levels, derivatives are equivalent of selling an arsonist a fire insurance policy on your house. It makes no sense, and the incentives are all backward. Attacks on Wall Street speculation. As was brilliantly documented in Michael Lewis's book, Flash Boys, Wall Street makes billions by buying huge quantities of stocks and bonds and then selling them shortly thereafter. The big investment houses and hedge funds have invested hundreds of millions of dollars in super high-speed computers that detect the slightest price movements, then execute trades in mere fractions of a second. Once the price goes up, sometimes just by a fraction of a penny per share, and after just a few seconds or even less, the traders dump the securities. When repeated tens of millions of times, the practice reaps an unbelievably enormous profit for Wall Street. Needless to say, this game of high-speed speculation adds absolutely nothing to a productive economy. What it does is make buying and selling securities more expensive for the vast majority of investors, including your pension fund or 401k administrator. And because it is largely computer-driven, it adds yet another destabilizing force to the financial markets. If we're serious about reforming our financial system, we have got to establish a tax on Wall Street speculators. We've got to discourage reckless gambling on Wall Street and encourage productive investments in a job-creating economy. By imposing a small financial transaction tax of just 0.5% on stock trades, that's just 50 cents for every $100 worth of stock, a 0.1% fee on bonds, and a 0.005% fee on derivatives, we would help tap the brakes on high-frequency speculative trading, and we would raise up to $300 billion a year, which I have proposed using to make public college and universities tuition-free. During the financial crisis, the middle class bailed out Wall Street. Now it's Wall Street's turn to bail out the middle class. Reforming credit rating agencies. We cannot have a safe and sound financial system if we're unable to trust the credit rating agencies to accurately rate the creditworthiness of financial products. And the only way we can have that trust is to make sure that credit rating agencies cannot make a profit from Wall Street. Leading up to the Great Recession, the three major credit agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's, and Fitch, would routinely give inflated AAA ratings to risky and sometimes worthless mortgage-backed securities and derivatives, even though the agencies knew the ratings were bogus. Without those AAA ratings, it is highly doubtful many investors, again including pension funds and 401k administrators, would have ever bought them. The reason these risky financial schemes were given such favorable ratings is simple. Wall Street paid for them. Rather than providing useful risk information to investors, which is the reason they exist in the first place, The credit rating agencies were colluding with Wall Street because that's where the money was. The rating agency's role in the Wall Street meltdown was extremely significant. By 2010, hundreds of billions of dollars of supposedly AAA mortgage-backed securities had been downgraded to junk status, where they should have been all along. But because they were purchased with the inflated credit ratings that commanded a premium price, more than $500 billion in value simply disappeared almost overnight. And that was before a single house was foreclosed on. Unfortunately, the ethical underpinnings and financial incentives within these agencies are fundamentally askew. When employees of Moody's were asked in an internal survey what their four highest job goals were, the top three were 1, generating more revenue, 2, increasing market share, and 3, fostering good relationships with customers. Fourth on the list was performing high-quality analytical work. Well, at least they were being honest. In my view, we need to turn for-profit credit rating agencies into transparent, non-profit institutions independent from Wall Street and accountable to a board of directors that represents the public interest. Wall Street must no longer be able to pick and choose which credit agency will rate their products. Ending usury. Having a financial system that works for all Americans means stopping financial institutions from ripping us off by charging sky-high interest rates and outrageous fees. To my mind, it's unacceptable that people all over the country pay a $3, $4, or $5 fee each time they go to the ATM. It is unconscionable that millions of Americans are paying credit card interest rates of 20 or 30%. The Bible, and virtually every major religion on earth, has a term for this practice. It's called usury. In the Divine Comedy, Dante reserved a special place in the seventh circle of hell for people who charged usurious interest rates. Today, we don't need the hellfire, the pitchforks, or the rivers of boiling blood, but we do need a national usury law that caps interest rates on credit cards and consumer loans at 15%. In 1980, Congress passed legislation requiring credit unions to cap interest rates on their loans, with some exceptions, at no more than 15%. And that law has worked very well, but unfortunately, it included only credit unions and not banks. That makes no sense to me. Unlike big banks, credit unions are member-owned and democratically controlled cooperatives that exist solely to provide affordable banking services to their members. Unlike big banks, credit unions didn't engage in risky behavior that caused the financial collapse. And unlike big banks, credit unions did not receive a huge bailout from taxpayers of this country. Credit unions are the good guys. While I support capping interest rates charged on the loans they make, we must extend this cap to every lender in America. Moreover, we must cap all ATM fees at $2. People should not have to pay a 10% fee for withdrawing $40 of their own money. Big banks need to stop acting like loan sharks and start acting like responsible lenders. Allow post offices to offer banking services. Today, rather unbelievably, there are millions of Americans who live in communities that are not served by regular banking services, places in which the giant banks don't think it's worth their time to invest. Well, what do you do if you live in such a neighborhood and need to cash a check? Where do you go? You go to a payday lender, who will likely charge an interest rate of over 300% and trap you into a vicious cycle of debt. That should not be allowed in the American financial system. We need to stop payday lenders from exploiting millions of Americans and making the poor even poorer. Post offices exist in almost every community in our country. One important way to provide decent banking opportunities for low-income communities is to allow the U.S. Postal Service to engage in basic banking services, which should include offering savings accounts, cashing checks, and wiring money. The vast majority of postal services around the world allow their consumers to do some banking, and so should we. Reforming the Federal Reserve. Lastly, we must fundamentally reform the Federal Reserve to make it responsive to the needs of ordinary Americans and not just billionaires on Wall Street. When the financial system was on the verge of collapse, the Federal Reserve acted with a fierce sense of urgency, offering $16 trillion in virtually zero-interest loans to banks and corporations throughout the world. The Fed helped save Wall Street. However, it did little to save Main Street. And as a result, millions of families saw a decline in their standard of living and a dimming of their hope for the future. The decisions that the Federal Reserve made during the crisis sent a very clear message. While the rich and powerful are too big to fail and are worthy of an endless supply of cheap credit, ordinary Americans must fend for themselves. This was a clear case of socialism for the rich and a rugged individualism for everyone else. But it doesn't need to be this way. The Fed was never supposed to be concerned just about Wall Street. Americans deserve a central bank that works for them and not just for the big banks. We must reform the Fed to make sure it acts with the same sense of urgency to fulfill its full employment mandate, increase wages, and rebuild the middle class as it did when it saved Wall Street. Let me outline how I believe we can do just that. First, we must strengthen, not weaken, the Volcker Rule, which prohibited commercial banks from gambling with the bank deposits of the American people. The Fed has got to make it crystal clear to large financial institutions that the era of excessive speculation is over. Second, the Fed must stop providing incentives for banks to keep money out of the economy. Since 2008, the Fed has been paying financial institution interest rates on excess reserves parked at the central bank. Reserves have grown to an unprecedented $2.2 trillion. Instead of paying banks interest on these reserves, the Fed should charge a fee that the Small Business Administration could use to provide direct loans and loan guarantees to small businesses. Third, as a condition of receiving financial assistance from the Fed, banks must commit to increased lending to creditworthy small businesses and manufacturers in a job-creating productive economy, reducing credit card interest rates, and helping underwater and struggling homeowners. Just think of all the productive short- and long-term investments that could be made in our country right now if Wall Street used the money it received from the Federal Reserve wisely. Instead of casino-style speculation, Wall Street could and should invest in helping to restore infrastructure, build affordable housing, and transform our energy system. Those are the types of investments that the Fed must encourage. Fourth, we must eliminate the blatant conflicts of interest at the Fed. The reality is that the Federal Reserve has been hijacked by the very bankers it is in charge of regulating. I think most people would be shocked to learn that Jamie Dimon, CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, served on the board of the New York Fed at the same time that his bank received a $391 billion Fed bailout. And he is not the only example. At least 18 current and former Fed board members were affiliated with banks and companies that received emergency loans from the Fed during the financial crisis. We can no longer allow the foxes to guard the henhouse at the Federal Reserve. Fifth, we must make the Federal Reserve more transparent. Too much of the Fed's business is conducted in secret, known only to the bankers on its various boards and committees. The only reason we even know about the Fed's jaw-dropping $16 trillion in-secret emergency lending during the financial crisis is because I inserted an amendment into the 2010 Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act to audit the Fed. We must require the Government Accountability Office to conduct a full and independent audit of the Fed each and every year. Currently, the Federal Open Market Committee does not release full and unredacted transcripts of its meetings to the public for 5 years. We must require the committee to release those transcripts within 6 months or less. If we had made this reform in 2004, the American people would have learned about the housing bubble well in advance of the financial crisis. The bottom line is that we need a Federal Reserve that works for all Americans, not just the CEOs of large financial institutions. 4. Healthcare for all. Healthcare is a right, not a privilege. The United States must join the rest of the industrialized world and guarantee healthcare to every man, woman, and child through a Medicare for all single-payer system. I have, for as far back as I can remember, always believed that healthcare is a right for all people, not a privilege. Healthcare is a basic human need. We all get born, we all get sick or have accidents, we all need care, and die at the end of our lives. Everyone needs healthcare. Everyone should have healthcare. It has never made sense to me that the quality of care a person receives, indeed whether that person receives any care, should be dependent upon the job that he or she has or the wealth of their family. It has never made sense to me that Americans should be forced into bankruptcy because of a serious illness. It has never made sense to me that some people will live and some people will die because of their health insurance status. Most important, it has never made sense to me that our healthcare system is primarily designed to make huge profits for multi-billion dollar insurance companies, drug companies, hospitals, and medical equipment suppliers. Healthcare is not a commodity. It is a human right. The goal of a sane healthcare system should be to keep people well, not to make stockholders rich. Let's be clear. While Republicans and representatives of the insurance and pharmaceutical industries tell us that we have the greatest healthcare system in the world, that is nonsense. Our current system is the most expensive, bureaucratic, wasteful, and ineffective in the world. While the healthcare industry makes hundreds of billions a year in profit, tens of millions of Americans have totally inadequate coverage, and many of our people suffer and die unnecessarily. The bottom line is that in the United States, we spend an enormous amount of money for a healthcare system that performs poorly. It's time for a change, a real change. Needless to say, the idea of universal healthcare is not a particularly radical idea. It exists 50 miles north of where I live in Burlington, Vermont. Canada guarantees healthcare for all its citizens through a single-payer healthcare system, and has done so for the past 30 years under governments with very different ideologies. In fact, universal healthcare exists in every major country on Earth except the United States. The national health systems may vary in each of these countries, but all of them guarantee health care for all their citizens, and none of them allow private health insurance companies to profit off human illness. Despite the gains of the Affordable Care Act, which I strongly supported, the health care situation in the United States remains dire. Over 28 million Americans lack any health insurance, and some 30 million are underinsured because of high deductibles and copayments. And these high deductibles and copayments are no joke. I have talked to people throughout the country who the official statistics say are insured, but it does not do them any good because they can't afford to go to the doctor due to those high deductibles and copayments. I've talked to seniors who cut their prescription drugs in half because they can't afford the outrageously high cost of their medicine. In America, you can be covered, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you're getting the healthcare you need. In Vermont and around the country, doctors have told me about patients who have died unnecessarily because they put off their medical visits until it's too late. These are people who had no insurance or lacked the out-of-pocket cash their insurance plans required them to pay. It's not talked about much, but thousands of people die each year in our country because they don't go to the doctor when they should. What an outrage. Further, there are millions of Americans with decent insurance coverage who can't find a medical home because we have a disastrous primary health care system, and many regions of the country are medically underserved. The goal of any rational health care system is to enable people to get medical care when they need that care. Obviously, That approach eases human pain and suffering. If people cannot find a doctor when they need medical care, they will only get sicker. It is also cost-effective. It is much more expensive to pay for extended hospital stays and the long-term treatment of chronic illness than to successfully treat medical conditions in their early stages. Today, in wealthy communities all across the country, there is an abundance of doctors, dentists, and other medical personnel. That is not the case in low-income areas, urban or rural. When I visited Mississippi, I found that there were entire, largely black counties in that state that had no doctors, no doctors at all. But it's not just a racial issue. There's a dire shortage of doctors in rural areas of largely white states of Kansas as well, and in many other regions in America. What do these millions of people do when they need medical care and don't have a doctor? Some of them simply delay treatment and get sicker. Others die. Most, however, go to the emergency room at the local hospital. Instead of having a doctor of their own who knows their family and their medical history, they get triage-style care in an emergency room. Not only is this an inadequate form of care, it is enormously expensive. An emergency room visit is the most expensive form of primary care in the country. As part of the Affordable Care Act, in order to address the crisis in primary health care, I helped lead the effort to greatly expand funding for the Federally Qualified Health Center FQHC program. Majority Leader Harry Reid, Congressman Jim Clyburn, and I, with the support of President Obama, were able to put an additional $11 billion into the program. This resulted in 6 million more Americans in medically underserved areas gaining access to primary health care, dental care, mental health counseling, and prescription drugs. 24 million Americans are now served by FQHCs across the country. And in the state of Vermont, almost 25% of our people now get their primary health care through these community health centers. We also tripled funding for the National Health Service Corps, the federal program that provides debt forgiveness for those medical, dental, and nursing school graduates prepared to practice in medically underserved areas. One of the many manifestations of an irrational healthcare system is that while we overpay certain types of providers, we grossly underpay those in primary care who are the backbone of any rational system. The National Health Service Corps helps to address that crisis. At the end of the campaign, I worked with Secretary Clinton to reach an agreement that calls for a doubling of funds for community health centers and a massive increase in funding for the National Health Service Corps. This proposal, if adopted, would go a long way toward providing universal primary care in this country. It would save lives, ease suffering, and save billions of taxpayer dollars. As a member of the U.S. Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions, I will do everything in my power to see that this proposal gets passed. Today, the United States spends far more per capita on health care than any other nation. According to the latest information, we spend $3.2 trillion a year on health care, about $10,000 for every man, woman, and child. In 2013, we spent 17.1% of our GDP on health care. This was almost 50% more than the next highest spender, France, and double what the United Kingdom spent. The goal of a sane and efficient healthcare system is to invest in the provision of healthcare and disease prevention. We should be spending money on doctors, nurses, mental health care specialists, dentists, nurse practitioners, social workers, and other personnel who provide real services to people and improve their lives. We should be investing in the research and development of new drugs and technologies that can cure disease and alleviate pain. We should not be wasting hundreds of billions of dollars a year on profiteering, on huge executive compensation packages, and on outrageous administrative costs. The waste and bureaucracy of the current system is almost unimaginable. Think for a moment about how much time and money is spent in this country as people argue with their insurance companies as to whether or not a particular procedure is covered, and understand that not paying claims is exactly what insurance companies do. Think about the many billions of dollars drug companies spend each year on television advertising telling us what drugs we need to buy, and the amount of money they spend trying to influence doctors to use their particular brand. Think about all the people working in the basements of hospitals throughout the country who are not treating patients or improving their lives, but rather billing them and in some cases hounding them for back payments they cannot afford. This waste of bureaucracy not only impacts patients and their relationship to insurance companies and hospitals, it is also doing incredible damage to the healthcare professionals. Just as patients are affected by our profit-driven system, so are healthcare providers. The doctors, nurses, and trained professionals whose job it is to care for the sick and injured and to prevent disease. The vast majority of healthcare professionals in this country are men and women who sought out healing professions because they wanted to care for people, wanted to make a difference in the lives of their neighbors and their community. These are not people who sought out careers where they would be forced to spend countless hours in front of a computer screen filling out forms or on the phone arguing with insurance companies on behalf of a patient. But that is a demoralizing reality in our current system as the provision of health care in America becomes more and more corporatized, more and more geared toward profit-making. Healthcare providers today spend less and less time treating their patients and more time justifying what they do and fighting to be paid by the insurance company for the services they render. As a result of this bureaucracy and insurance company interference, too many doctors and other medical professionals are giving up on the profession they love. Every day, they must consider a host of questions completely unrelated to the needs of their patients. They must determine whether the services they render and the amount of time they spend will be paid for by the insurance company, whether the facility where they work will think they're working efficiently enough, whether the patients will be able to receive any follow-up care. In a doctor's office today that accepts Medicare, Medicaid, and private